became engaged to three men, and all three of them had a horrible fate. The kiss of death, girl.
How'd you get in the cellar?
When I came to, I saw this face bending over me. White, smiling, like death.
Oh, Lucky, you've got to get out of here.
Not without you.
Look out!
You'll die like all the fools who try to marry Eleanor.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age, by John Woolley, Dan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you, Michael H. Price, for that wonderful introduction, and folks, welcome back to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast. My name is John Woolley. As Michael said, I'm here with Michael, who is, among other things, the originator of the Forgotten Horrors series of books, and, lest we forget, Mantan Moreland's official biographer.
And, how did that happen?
I'm sure we'll find out. It was wonderful, the book you did on Mantan Moreland. Is a wonderful book, and I think that's a good place to start as any, because what we're talking about tonight, Michael, is The Smiling Ghost, which is not dealt with in any of the Forgotten Horrors books, a film from 1941, and the reason it's not dealt with is because it came from a major studio, a B-picture, but a major studio.
Forgotten Horrors books deal generally, well, in print form at least, with the independents.
Exactly. But yet, this is a film that, you turned me on to it, and I just think it's a film that that needs to be talked about a little bit, especially since it was seen, I believe, was it on Turner Classic? Is that right?
Yes, that's where it has found apparently a permanent home, and all the better for it.
Well, let's talk about, there's a lot of things to talk about with the film, but because we've talked about this many times before, and you have a very interesting take on the whole idea of the African-American comics, Mantan Moreland, and in this film, Willie Best, who did a lot of the feats do your duty dialogue throughout Smiling Ghosts. And how do you feel about that sort of comedy? Because a lot of people are uneasy with it.
Well, I've got to say, the first couple of times I interviewed Bob Hope, during the 70s and 1980s, I think that was three occasions, the topic of Willie Best always came up, and it was usually Bob Hope who brought up the topic, and you would expect him to have great fondness for those with whom he worked, but in particular, he kept citing Willie Best as the, how did he put it, says, I'm not just making a pun here, he was the best comedian I ever worked with.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's hard. It's not entirely correct to say never mind the black stereotypes,
mm-hmm.
because you've got to mind them. You've got to find, okay, this is an indefensible stereotype, and yet here's an actor making the most of it in what limited circumstances the Hollywood economic system and cultural system would allow him. Willie did, in retrieving his full name, Willie Best, he was from Sunflower, Mississippi, and showed up in films with the Marx Brothers, Bob Hope, Laurel and Hardy, Wayne Morris, in the case of The Smiling Ghost. In the earlier 30s, he had been assigned the extremely demeaning name Sleep and Eat, which was, of course, a studio attempt to recapture some of the vibe given off by Lincoln Perry, who
Step
traveled under the name of Step and Fetch It.
Sure.
And you see, well, of course, you see Robert Townsend parodying that Sleep and Eat image.
Yes.
In Hollywood Shuffle, what, 1980, middle 80s, 86, I believe. And then, of course, in more recent times, you find Spike Lee not only parodying the image, but getting extremely indignant about it with due cause. Spike Lee, in his film Bamboozled, took especially to task Mantan Moreland and Willie Best.
To the extent of naming characters.
It's like, I don't think I'm quite as mad at those guys as Spike Lee must be. And in fact, his portrayal of the Mantan character in Bamboozled pretty well drove Mantan Moreland's daughter into seclusion for several years.
Oh, I did not know. Oh, yes, I did know that. Didn't you deal with that in your...
Yes,
in your
we dealt... Marcella Moreland and I dealt with that in very practical terms, once we had become cordially acquainted, and I deliberately made a very cautious approach because I did not want to advance her gun-shy attitude.
Sure, sure.
A lot of people at the time, this would be the early part of the new century, were very interested in confronting anyone associated with Mantan Moreland and said, well, how can you be proud of this this indefensible stereotype? And in the first place, I think probably Mantan more so than Willie Best made a point of inverting and parodying the very stereotypes that Hollywood was applying to him. Willie had some very wise observations in his character parts that I'm sure were improvised. Probably my favorite subversive line in an African-American stereotypical role is the one that Lincoln Perry gave as Step and Fetch It in a Charlie Chan picture. Charlie Chan in Egypt, and of course he's a Southern American at large, and in the land of the pharaohs, he becomes enchanted with a Nubian princess over there, and at one point says to her, why don't you come back, I'm paraphrasing here, why don't you come back to Mississippi with me? I know some folks down there who give you a good job. And it's like, that's pretty bitter and awfully droll.
Right, right.
And I'm surprised the film made it to the film allowed that line in the final cut.
Well, you know, you have been involved, I know you were involved with the Tyler, Texas, that find of African-American films made for African-American audiences.
Oh, yeah, and, the Tyler, Texas Black Film Collection at Southern Methodist University.
And you found the same, and I know it's been, for me, I interviewed Herb Jeffries a couple of times. And of course,
oh, what a great guy.
What a wonderful guy, and of course, a black singing cowboy in all African-American Westerns, and he had the same sort of comics in his pictures, and I'm sure that's been your experience as well, that there were the same sort of comics in black pictures that they the same sort of black comics in black pictures that there were in white pictures.
Oh, I think it's quite insightful to observe that in the films made expressly for black neighborhood theaters, the stereotypical business runs about as thick as it does in major studio and small studio Hollywood pictures. And well, what are you going to do? Late in life, not extremely late, but in his advanced years, Mantan Moreland did a really vividly realized record album of recitations from a once album. And I told him not to do it that way. I told him not to do it. I told him it was too caricatured.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it anyway. And I said, yes, and I think we're probably the richer for his having done it. Because, for one thing, Mantan did not affect that voice. That was his natural Louisiana speaking voice.
Right, right.
And smart as a whip. He was Mantan, among Willie Best, Mantan, and Eddie Anderson, who was better known as Rochester with Jack Benny. Those three constituted the primary black comedians in old Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And there was, I remember Herb Jeffries talking not all that kindly about Clarence Muse, who, of course, was not a comedian, but was a black actor back then. And I think that he talked about using him in some of his films, but never actually used him. But he did use comics. And again, it's easy, I suppose, for me to sit here and talk about it because I've never had the African-American experience, but Willie Best is pretty doggone funny in this picture.
Imagine falling into a soft job like this. It's too bad it's such a short-term contract.
Maybe if you make good, boss, you'll take up your option.
She's not only beautiful, she's intelligent. She's got brains enough for two people.
That's right, boss. She may be just a girl for you. What?
Willie Best is right up to Bob Hope's definition. He's got whiplash timing.
He does
the double take, that is, the looks once, then has to look again to make sure he saw what he thought he saw. And he does it not with the anger of, say, Edgar Kennedy, one of the great double take comedians, or the amusement of Oliver Hardy. He does it as if, like, I got to reinforce this impression while it's fresh. What is the smiling ghost about? Well, it's about ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
Except is it or isn't it a real haunting? You get the impression that a lot of people think that the so-called smiling ghost of the title is, in fact, a supernatural manifestation.
Yeah, back from the dead, right.
Yes, it's a whodunit with the emphasis on the hoodoo.
And it's kind of an uneven picture in some ways because it's very funny in parts and it's pretty scary in parts. Now,
tries to be very funny. The essential story is very grim. There was a time in old Hollywood when horror and humor could coexist more gracefully than they do today.
Yes.
Where you're actually laughing at the situations that you, the viewer, identify with, instead of laughing at the misfortunes of some hapless character who's, well, as in Friday the 13th, most people that I know today watch those splat pictures of, the past 30 or 40 years as though they were comedies.
Yes. As though they were splat stick, is the term.
It's splat stick.
Uh-huh.
But pictures like The Smiling Ghost, which descend from the Broadway tradition of the 1920s called mystery farce,
yes,
usually involve a severely grim situation that is leavened by the humor of people reacting as, caricatured normal civilian human beings would to such desperate circumstances.
Which is the case here with the smiling ghost. Willie Best, who just pretty much steals the picture in a lot of ways and has a very big part. He's the, valet or companion.
Secretary. Vice President.
of Wayne Morris, who's a chemical engineer and not very successful, who gets offered a certain amount of money to pretend to marry an heiress who is played by Alexis Smith. And called the Kiss of Death Girl.
And of course, her suitors end up croaked,
yes,
not too fine a point on it.
That's exactly right. And in the cast, I mean, this is Warner Brothers, and you can see, like, even with the lighting styles and things, but also some great supporting characters. Alan Hale Sr. Is in it in a big role.
Oh,
you know,
big,
David
big
Bruce.
Damon Runyon-type role.
Oh, very Damon Runyon-esque, that's right. And David Bruce, who, of course, we Universal kids know as the Mad Ghoul. And Clem Bevins goes clear back to the Silent Days, and he's even got a little bit of a role in this as the sexton in the graveyard.
Yes.
But my theory is that, Michael, that any film that has an iron lung in it is not that funny. And
you know
what I mean? It has a certain amount of grimness involved.
The iron lung, which I suppose has pretty well been retired to the museums of medical history by now.
Yes.
Given advances in technology. But what an intimidating machine that was.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
To think that someone would not only find it a boon to existence, but
yes,
also necessary to existence. We've got, I think it's in the second Forgotten Horrors book, we've got another iron lung thriller called The Nighthawk.
Yes.
In which a mob of gangsters conspires to steal one of the things in order to threaten a renegade gangster with the impending death of his short of breath kid brother.
Oh.
And a mighty weird touch. I find that that's one of the elements that makes the smiling ghost so fundamentally grim.
Yes, I agree.
Of course, when Wayne Morris, who played the innocent, innocuous schlub so
well. Kind of a big lug, isn't he? He's just kind of a big lug in this picture.
When he shows up with Willie Best in tow, it becomes very plain that Willie Best is the brains of this act.
Absolutely.
All due respect to Wayne Morris, but Willie was a crackerjack. He playing the, of course, you get into this house full of eccentric family members, ruling class eccentrics, and one of the first things you find out is one of the creepier inmates appears to intend. Well, he's a head collector.
Yeah, just shrink.
He collects tribal,
head. Yeah.
Drunken heads, and he sees Willie Best over here, and does not recognize the ethnicity right off, and pegs him as a member of some exotic tribe, and decides he must have a representation of that magnificent head in his collection.
Which becomes
a running
gag.
This generates all sorts of unease beyond what this so-called smiling ghost is up to.
Remarkable. Superb.
What?
Your head is perfect.
Oh, thank you, sir.
What a perfect frontal cerebral protrusion.
Does it show?
Yes. You've had it from birth?
Uh-oh. I got it decoration day in a private jam session.
Young man, have you ever considered the instability of human existence? Here today, gone tomorrow. How would you like to stay with us for a long, long time?
Oh, I'd like that. Thank you, sir.
Let me thank you.
Well, to talk, as you said earlier, about the roots and the theater, this is kind of one of those old dark, or it sort of evolves into an old dark house kind of situation.
Very much an old dark house type of picture, which I consider practically a subgenre anyway.
Right. Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, Wayne Morris is an interesting character. I guess he never really hit the stardom level that a lot of people thought he deserved. He's a very likable guy. He did, I guess, if you by most yardsticks, I think a lot of film fans would say that he was the last B Western star.
He was very much in that vein.
I mean, he did that little run of films for Allied
Star
artists.
Of Texas and a couple of others.
Yeah.
A very bland face.
Yes.
And kind of a Jimmy Stewart manner about him.
He did. And, of course, the return of when he's the star, the hero in the Return of Dr. X, where he's pretty butch in that one, but he's a little bit more kind of the befuddled, likable comedy horror hero in this one. And then those B-Westerns, have you seen any of those he did back 53 and 54?
The not ones
he did
in for many Allied years.
It's been a
I
long
saw
time
them
for
when
me
they
too.
Were relatively new, that is, in television syndication.
Right, right.
But, he was one of the last big-timers to, you know, what killed the cowboy movie? A lot of people say Shane was the last cowboy movie.
Right.
I think it was more television than the emergence of a more mature narrative style in the Western.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the TV episodes, the episodic adventures of the cowboys just stole every plot line and probably, well, not no probably, too, a lot of the writers for the B-Westerns went into television.
Oh, yeah. Well, by which time, of course, the more important or more commercially successful movie cowboys had already detoured into television anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, sometimes with their old movies like William Boyd, their old movies in tow and all uh-huh. chopped up and ready to become TV series.
Yeah, that's why all those Roy Rogers movies got butchered,
right.
Cutting them down for TV.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, he's got two really good female leads here, Alexis Smith and Brenda Marshall. And you never really know, and we won't be spoilers on this, you never really know which one is going to win his heart, but it's essentially one of those endless Ginger and Marianne situations, you know, with Alexis Smith being the Ginger and Brenda Marshall being the plucky newspaper reporter.
Oh, yeah.
And Alexis Smith was another one who I really thought she should have been a bigger star than she was.
Well, there's no room for all the potential stars.
That's right.
Some of them have to fade into the background and, you know, marry famous studio executives.
Well, that's probably true. You know, when you start thinking about the people who were stars, and she was a contract player. I guess all these people were contract players at the
right.
time.
Right, Warner Brothers had contract players. That wasn't a guarantee of security, but it was a guarantee of visibility until you really might click with an audience or make the right impression on the front office.
Now, as I understand, Alexis Smith ended up marrying Craig Stevens, correct?
I believe that's right.
I believe she and Craig Stevens were married, and then Brenda Marshall ended up with William Holden.
Yes.
She was married to William Holden for many years.
Amazing.
Is that correct? I think I'm right on that.
Yes.
I think that's right. And, you know, she made a couple of big films with Harold Flynn, but most of the time she was in that position like Alexis Smith. She was a second lead in A pictures and a main lead in B pictures.
Yep.
And that
yep.
was really the way the studio system worked. And it's kind of, I don't know if this is the time to go into it, but the whole notion of B pictures and the guaranteed play dates prior to 1947. If you were a major studio and you could make a certain amount of B pictures for not very much money, try out your untested talent and
right.
And send them out knowing because you could block book and you owned your own theaters that a certain amount of theaters would have to take these films and play them on a flat rate rather than a percentage. And mm-hmm. so you weren't going to make a lot of money, but you weren't going to lose any money. And so
no, there were guarantees attached to those B pictures that really, well, it was the B pictures that made the big prestigious pictures possible.
Exactly. Exactly.
No one could really tell if a top of the line picture was going to be a hit or a dud. But the B pictures had a built-in audience of loyalists, and the reason they had these built-in audiences was that you got to see players in starring roles that looked kind of interesting in the background of the bigger pictures.
Right.
And you got to see the great comedians given free rein, like Willie Best.
Well, that's true, yeah. Well, of course, you got to see that a little bit in the A pictures, too. Willie Best did some, well, as Bob Hope would testify to, made some pretty big pictures.
Oh, yeah. And the work at Paramount with Bob Hope and the Ghostbreakers kind of set the template for the truer Willie Best character. He's very good in the earlier pictures where he had that demeaning pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time of the Ghostbreakers, coupled with really good scripts, top-notch production values, and the promotional clout of a large studio. Willie Best made himself, he radiated star quality, whether or not Hollywood ever treated him as a star.
Right, right. But he was reliable and he was funny. Again, you've been comparing him a little bit to Bantan Moreland, and I think that's pretty fair. That's a pretty fair comparison. Bantan Moreland, of course, I think, didn't he work more the smaller studios? I mean, he had that whole thing with Monogram, as you wrote about in your book, where he had a separate contracts for both writing and acting. And
I wish I could get a gig like that where you're paid as a writer when all you do, it's a great deal, when you don't really write a script.
Right.
Where you're being paid to improvise as though you were a contributing writer.
Right.
What a deal. And of course, you can see that all over. I think Willie Best was a very strong improviser. I think Mantan probably had the edge on him. Totally different types of personality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Willie never appeared the least bit indignant, but he always got his legs in.
Well, you know, that's right. I never thought about that, but that's true. Mantan was full of being indignant.
Well, Mantan's presence in those films is a perpetual objection to what the dominant culture players around him perceive as second-class citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can sleep in the servants' quarters. What do you mean?
You're thinking now about what is that? That's King of the Zombies.
King of the Zombies,
yeah,
yes.
Sure.
And you find many lines like that. I think Mantan is probably at his best in the Monogram comedy Mysteries he did with Frankie Darrow, where there is no class or culture barrier between the star players.
No, they treated each other absolutely as equals. They were on the lower socioeconomic rungs, generally.
Right. You've got the feisty Irish kid. You've got the extremely wise and hesitant voice of reason in Mantan. And they're buddies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and this is generations before. This is generations before Danny Glover and Mel Gibson.
Right, right.
Generations before I Spy.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And it's like, was this a template for something really influential? Well, then how come these guys who originated the approach didn't benefit more?
Well, they did it for small. They did it for Poverty Row Studio, and there you go. And Best really worked more for the major studios.
Willie Best was more with the majors until, he did Cabin in the Sky, Mark mm-hmm. Twain, after The Smiling Ghost. Another good little picture from the same year, 1941, as The Smiling Ghost, called The Body Disappears.
Yes, yes.
With Jeffrey Lynn in the ostensible lead. And of course, David Bruce again. I didn't really associate Willie Best with the smaller studios. Oh gosh, until he started showing up in the Columbia serials, which were like borderline Poverty Row.
Borderline, that's right. They were kind of almost like the Republic, kind of in between Poverty Row and the majors, weren't they?
Right. Columbia had become a major studio in the 30s with that big Oscar breakthrough, but that's the original name of Columbia was CBC Pictures, after the initials of its founders, and the reason that Harry Cohn changed the name to Columbia was because he got tired of smart Alex in the trade referring to the CBC as corned beef and cabbage.
Well, as you say, it was the B pictures that sometimes kept the studios afloat because they could be guaranteed. And it's kind of hard to explain in this day and age what the booking practices were of the studios. I alluded to that earlier. You know, before the antitrust of the government stepped in and finally made it to where, number one, that studios could not own their own movie theaters, which they could do before 1940. Is it 47 or 48? I never remember.
Well, that blows hot and cold, John. They had been forced out of movie theater ownership during the Depression, too.
Right, but then they kind of built back up.
You know, right? it's like the recent experience with Sony and Lowe's theaters.
Mm-hmm.
The big Sony or Lowe's, depending depending on what day of the week it was, almost. You know, the sign could change literally with the winds of antitrust regulation changing.
Right.
And I was backstage at the big Lowe's Theater one day and noticed that they kept a Sony sign in readiness.
Really?
And of course, it was an open secret. The studios love to control where their product plays. That's probably not as evil a practice as it sounds, because you're going to be guaranteed of an outlet of quality.
Right, right.
Because, yeah, we want first-class theaters running what we consider first-class pictures. But at the same time, well, you know, heck, AT&T was a better company when it was a monopoly. So that's a bit of a mixed blessing.
I don't think we've ever had
so many bad and unqualified telephone companies right. in existence as we do right now.
But for the movie part of it, I mean, that whole antitrust thing did change. It also, I think, maybe even more important than divesting the theaters was the notion of block booking had to be done away with.
Block booking had a tremendous impact.
And that was... To really kind of oversimplify it, a studio could come to a theater and say, you can have, say, MGM, you can have our next Clark Gable, but you need to buy these 20 B pictures.
Right.
And that's why B pictures could always be guaranteed of being able to make a certain amount of money.
And, of course, the B pictures often were more interesting and sometimes even better than the big studio productions that they supported.
Well, they have been. I mean, as far as you and I are concerned, I think most of what we talk about are the B pictures, the more unsung and unheralded pictures, like, again, The Smiling Ghost, which is, you know, it's got the Warner Brothers look. It's got that crisp, low-key lighting look. It's got a great cast that are all really B picture actors and stock company character actors like Willie Best and Alan Hale, and even David Bruce. Although I think there was a kind of a forlorn attempt to make David Bruce a leading man at one point, maybe at Universal, which didn't work out very well. But you know, they were made, as Jules Pfeiffer said famously about comic books, they were made simply to be liked.
Yeah.
There was nothing else involved. They just were there to be liked. And
sometimes having the freedom to create rather than follow formulas, the people who made the B pictures were able to experiment with techniques that became necessary components of the much larger pictures.
Well, look at Edgar Ulmer. I mean, everybody throws his name out there, but he loved working for Poverty Row, for PRC,
mm-hmm.
because if he could do whatever he wanted within a certain budget.
Creative autonomy, as long as you follow that, that standard of keeping it as cheap as possible.
That's
here's
right.
Here's your $45,000. Spend it wisely.
Go make me a film, and that's all you need to know. So.
Oh yeah.
Well,
the studio in Dallas. Called SAC Amusements that
Which
made
was,
so
yeah.
many of those
yeah.
films in the Tyler, Texas Black Film Collection. The Dallas studio, when they employed Spencer Williams, later
yes.
known as Andy Brown on Amos and Andy, when they employed him to write, direct, produce, and star in a long string of pictures from the early to late 40s, the whole objective was to corral this talent who had a knack for taking $10,000 and making a movie that could make many, many times that amount at the box office.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this was without dominant culture theaters.
Right, right.
This was strictly in the arena of the black neighborhood movie theater.
Right, right.
It's quite amazing.
And Spencer Williams is
that's why the Lone Star Western's at Monogram. That's why the any number of B pictures that became not without really trying to that became standards for such genres as film noir.
Right.
I don't think there really was even such a term in popular usage when RKO, for example, made Stranger on the Third Floor.
Good point. It's mostly
post-war. And you
look
at what Stranger on the Third Floor influenced, beginning, of course, with the Val Lewton pictures at RKO, and you see just about the essence of why and how these films were so important.
Well, and to get back to the Smiling Ghost and wrap that up, there's some noir elements there. There's comedy elements. There's straight horror elements. But it all really, it's very swift. It's a very swift picture. All of the elements really work. What do you know about the director? I mean, he seemed to have been pretty much just a company man for Warner Brothers.
One of the stock workhorses who never broke out. Lewis Seiler had been, he was virtually retired from film when Talkies came in.
Mm-hmm.
But soldiered on. I mean, he became, I say retired. He was out of the mainstream by the arrival of the Talkies. The start of the talking picture era in the early Depression years found him directing Spanish language versions of other pictures, mm-hmm. of Hollywood, English-speaking pictures.
So he kind of mounted a comeback then.
He mounted a comeback. I guess the turnaround picture for Seiler must have been Charlie Chan in Paris.
Right, right.
He was very versatile. He was. He had started out in slapstick comedy, so of course there's a lot of slapstick in The Smiling Ghost.
Mm-hmm. Especially the end. We won't give it away, but the ending is pretty much all slapstick. Or the coda, I guess you should say. But the whole thing, the thing threatens to go off the rails about the last 5 minutes. It's just goofy.
A desperate chase that should be scarier.
That's exactly
I'll forgive
right.
it that. Yeah, you'll find Seiler's in command of both aspects
right.
of the picture, the grim and the often hilarious. In many ways, the picture reminds me of a bigger picture that Lewis Seiler had done. That being, which one of those darn things was it? One of the Dead End Kids pictures.
Oh,
Hell's
okay.
Kitchen.
Okay.
And, of course, he was a workhorse at Warner Brothers.
Right, right. And pretty much stayed around there for a good long time, too.
Mm-hmm. I think he retired in late 50s.
I believe that's right, yeah. Well, I think we both recommend the picture, would we not, for the listeners?
Oh, yes,
yeah.
Yes. The listener who is willing to look at a picture as a product of its time and not to expect it to apply enlightened modern-day attitudes to social conditions of 1941.
I think that's a very good way to put it.
That's, I've often asked, where the heck was the Ebonics movement when Willie Best and Mantan Moreland needed it?
Right, right, exactly.
Willie and Mantan did not have the anchorage of Jack Benny that Rochester Anderson
right,
enjoyed.
Right,
and they paid for it. Willie got out of the business, ended up running a liquor store in Los Angeles for the remainder of his life.
And Mantan, I remember seeing him in Spider Baby. I think maybe it was one of the last things that he did, correct?
He was actually, the last stuff he did was even later than that, in the early 70s, a really good black independent of the early 70s called Watermelon Man.
Oh, yes, I know, with Godfrey Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and, of course, he steals the show.
Sure,
every
sure.
time he shows up.
Of course, of course.
It's like... talents of this caliber must be regarded as kind of the advance guard, and
yes.
they took a lot of licks. They were denied the opportunity to come to the starring position and command the show, so they just stole it from the sidelines.
And they just played the cards they were dealt, as we've often said. And Michael, we've been talking about the Mantan Moreland book. Can people still get that?
Last time I looked.
Okay, good. Well, and the title,
I think it's right there on Amazon.com.
And the title is?
What a nice thing that was to be able to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's Mantan the Funny Man.
Yes.
You were going to call. I remember you telling me, I hope I'm not revealing anything, but remember at one point you wanted to call it In Search of Historic Mantan, which I would have loved to the scene. What else have we got out there? I know that we're, let's see what we can pimp now. I think we've come to that portion of the program. Forgotten Horrors 5, of course, is out there, and also Forgotten Horrors Comics and Stories.
Yes,
both available from
the two books were kind of the peak of our accomplishments for the past couple of years, barring a couple of bigger independent free agent projects that you and I had on the side.
Right.
But and of course we've got the fully revised original Forgotten Horrors book.
Yes,
in print.
Yes, which just got a great review from my friend Dennis King.
Very grateful for that.
Well, Dennis is a discerning man, and it certainly deserves it. People who may not have heard the podcast before, Forgotten Horrors Comics and Stories gathers up several pieces in comic book form, including Rocket Ship XM and Destination Moon. I think, do you have any of your certified licenses to commit
License to perpetrate existentialism.
Perpetrate existentialism in either of those
stories? Oh, that's all over everything I do anymore.
I know it is.
It's like, that's kind of ridiculous, but when in doubt, overdo it.
And it reprints also the comic book that I did with the artist Bruce McCorkendale, a Tor Johnson Hollywood star.
Oh, yeah.
It has, and Jan Allen Henderson, our frequent collaborator, checks in as well with a piece, with a text piece. And I'm very proud of that book.
I'm happy with the way all of our collaborative pieces have turned out.
Right on.
We've got, how many more of those, you know?
Well, you know, I guess, we'll keep on doing it, I guess, until somebody tells us to stop, until we run out of ideas. And
well, we've both been caught and sent back a few times.
Not for the last time either.
No, I'm sure of that. And it's like, your hot schlock horror from, 1991
is
still in existence.
It is still in existence.
One of the seminal horrors books, actually.
Thank you. It's certainly in that same spirit. And we're going to give the book, we're giving one away for the person who wrote my website from the last podcast, and that would be John Locke of Elkhorn, California. He's getting a copy. He didn't want one of the rare unautographed copies, so I'll sign the copy for John and send it on. We also want to mention a couple of our friends that are doing podcasts and blogs and all of this sort of thing. One is the Movie Waffler. Do you know the Movie Waffler?
That's a new one on me.
Well, the Movie Waffler has apparently is that correct, Joey? Has written about us?
Well, he's been supportive.
He's been supportive. He's been very supportive of us, so we wanted to do
great.
A shout-out. Also, Terry Frost of Paleo Cinema down in Australia has been supportive of our podcast as well. And he did a Nightmare Alley podcast. And it was very interesting to see someone, we did our Nightmare Alley podcast not too long ago, to see the differences and the similarities, how someone outside of the United States, a perceptive person outside of the United States would view Nightmare Alley. So we were talking about, let's see if I've got my paper over here, because I've got to say this just exactly right. Joey, if I get this wrong, our producer Joey Hambrick here behind us, if I get this wrong, when this post goes up, there will be a link. Matter of fact, if people are hearing it, the post is up now, right?
Well, yeah, when the podcast goes up the ether.
So when the podcast is up in the ether, as a matter of fact, if you're hearing my voice, the podcast must be up in the ether. And so Joey has posted the link to this show on our Facebook group. And Michael, you've been writing on the Facebook group. I know I've been very entertained about your involvement with the Sheena Queen of the Jungle stage play down in Fort Worth.
Whoop-de-doo, yeah, that's back on track after a couple of rainouts.
Oh, good, very good.
Yes, yes.
This is when I wish I lived closer. And so if the first five people who will share that link, and you just have to hit the share button, is that
the share button on my post.
Share button on your post, Joey Hambrick's post.
Right.
Hit that share button. The first five people to share that link will all get copies of Hot Schlock Horror. That's just because we're the kind of people we are, Michael. And also because I've got plenty of Hot Schlock Horrors, but that's a different story entirely. So, and next time, see if you can come up with five things of yours from the past, and we'll give yours away next time.
I think I'm surrounded by the time. At least I've got them stored safely away.
Yeah, I think so, too. You never know when there's going to be a wobbly table or something, you know, and you can stick a few issues in.
Yes, it's the perfect item of home repair without having to call a contractor.
That's exactly right. Michael, it's great as always. Thank you so much. We want to thank everybody for listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast, wherever you are. Thanks so much. And check out, what's the website, Joey Hambrick? It's my website, right? Which is, if you want to do the website, it's www.johnwooley, johnwooley.com. And you have a blog spot, Michael.
Oh, yes, at www.forgottenhorrors.blogspot.com.
And then, barons of the social media, we also have a Facebook. And what's our Facebook, Joey?
Just search for Forgotten Horrors on Facebook.
Search for Forgotten Horrors on Facebook. Find where you can share it. Hit the share. That's all you have to do. And let us know, and you'll get a copy of the 1991 Hot Schlock Horror.
And talk about weird movies on our Facebook group. That's
awesome. Yeah, okay, yes. Talk about weird movies on our Facebook page.
Yeah, because we want to get a conversation started.
Yeah.
That's why we're here, and the more interactive we can make it, the better off everyone turns out to be.
That's right. If anyone would like, has a film that would like to get the Forgotten Horrors podcast treatment, we will certainly entertain that.
Yeah, somebody suggested, one of the Facebook participants, I'm sorry the name won't come to mind right now, suggested Kitty Swan's Jungle Pictures.
Kitty Swan's Jungle Pictures.
Gungala, the Panther Girl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she worked with that fellow who made... made the Turkey Monster movie.
The Blood Freak?
She and Stephen Hawke worked on a couple of imitation Tarzan pictures together.
Now, that was, you're talking about Blood Feast, Blood Freak, the
Blood
hideous cape
Freak
on of Doom?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, I know that picture. Matter of fact, I have that picture. Maybe Blood Freak would be a good one to talk about at some point. Or those, do you have any either of those jungle pictures?
No, and I've seen one of them, and I find that they're awfully interesting. I think, as Herschel Gordon Lewis was told once by a French interviewer, perhaps Mr. Lewis's pictures are worthy of further research.
And Herschel Gordon Lewis said, "Yes, and so is cancer."
The punchline intact.
Very good. Well, until next time, Michael, thanks. And thanks to everybody for listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast. Anything else we got, Joey?
I think that's it.
Joey says goodbye. Goodbye, Michael.
Back with you soon.
All right.